Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up, I'll speak with Jewish Hospital's Dr. Roberto Bolli about his upcoming stem cell research. First, in the last 5 months, Kentucky has faced the two largest power outages in its history. The blackouts have reignited discussion among citizens and government officials on what it would take to better protect the electricity grid from future disasters. Gabe Bullard has more on the debate here in Louisville.
The windstorms in September and the ice storm in January knocked down more than 20,000 power lines in the Louisville area. 1 week after the ice storm, Louisville Gas and Electric Company spokesperson Brian Phillips watched a utility crew pull one of those lines out of a frozen pine tree near Bowman Field.
We're working on jobs now that are a little bit more tedious and time-consuming and bring up fewer pockets of customers.
That tedium during longer outages has many residents wondering why the power company doesn't replace overhead lines with underground cables that would be less susceptible to falling limbs. Utility officials have long said the cost would be astronomical, but Phillips adds that there's also a practical downside to that idea, as underground lines can still malfunction and repair work can be much more labor-intensive.
With underground, you have to dig to isolate the problems, and that can take longer, and it can also result in lengthier restoration times.
Norman Morton lives in Windy Hills, where the lines are buried, connected by subterranean transformers.
About one every four square blocks.
And you had, your power went out recently.
Went out at the beginning and did not come back on until 9 days later.
Morton says no one at LG&E could tell him why his two-year-old underground lines went out during the ice storm.
I guess we had reports of half a dozen two-man crews and cars coming by and looking, not even getting out of the cars, just driving around looking. I don't know what they thought they were going to see, because there's nothing to look at.
It is not a silver bullet. It is not a panacea. People that have buried utility lines suffer disruptions.
Louisville Metro Councilman Tom Owen represents the so-called urban forest area, which includes the Highlands. He favors a multi-year pilot program for burying lines. That way, the power company could work out the kinks and avoid needlessly burying lines in places where overhead transmission isn't hazardous.
Buried lines are an excellent idea. How to get from an excellent idea to a reality, at best, would take decades, not years. And require a significant consensus building.
Duke Energy is starting such a program in North Carolina, and Councilman Owen says now is the time to build consensus to do the same here. People who lost power to falling limbs are speaking out, and last week, Mayor Jerry Abramson asked LG&E to present the public with options for improving the infrastructure. Owen says that's a good step.
I am not optimistic that in the short term, that any significant burying will occur. But the good news is that we're going to have the discussion and we're going to focus on the cost.
To bury the lines, LG&E would have to dig up sidewalks, streets, and yards, and convince phone and internet providers to bury their lines as well. It averages out to $1 million per mile, most of which would likely be paid for through rate increases.
When you're building something new, or when you're replacing old components, then it makes much more sense to look at undergrounding.
Peter Fox Penner is an energy consultant for the Brattle Group, based in Washington, D.C. He says 9 out of 10 new subdivisions in the U.S. have underground lines, and the rest will get them as the current infrastructure becomes obsolete and is replaced with new technology, which will have to happen if renewable energy and green energy become standard.
I think it should be done when the power grid starts to be modernized as part of that.
Fox Penner says a full modernization would cost upwards of $800 billion. President Obama has talked about modernizing the power grid, leaving open the possibility that some of that money might be available from the federal government. But in the meantime, there are other costs. Metro government and LG&E have spent millions in the last 5 months repairing damage caused by storms. And businesses and residents have also paid, spending days in the dark while power lines are pulled out of trees. For WFPL, I'm Gabe Bullard.
The University of Louisville and Jewish Hospital announced last week that they'll participate in a clinical trial involving the use of adult cardiac stem cells to treat heart disease. It's the first research of its kind in the world. I spoke with study leader Dr. Roberto Bolli, who holds the Distinguished Chair in Cardiology at Jewish Hospital's Heart and Lung Institute. He begins our conversation discussing how the trial will work.
We are going to enroll patients who have heart failure and who had a previous heart attack, meaning that there is a scar in their heart, and our goal is to replace that scar with new heart muscle. These are patients that need to undergo open heart surgery, usually because they need a coronary artery bypass. During surgery, we will collect a small sample of their heart. We will freeze it, and then we will send it to Boston, to Harvard Medical School, where our colleagues will isolate the stem cells from that sample of tissue. They will grow the cells in vitro until they have approximately 1 million cells, and then they will send them back to us. And at that point, we will inject these cells into the same patient from which the sample had been harvested before. And then we will follow the patient for 2 years to see if we can detect an improvement in heart function. So the advantage of using these cells is that they are the patient's own cells, so there is no rejection. And also, since they are already present in the heart under normal conditions, We believe that they're better suited to regenerate the heart as compared to stem cells isolated from other tissues, such as, let's say, the bone marrow. And so we are very, very excited about using these cells. This will be the first time in the world that stem cells isolated from the heart are being used in patients. There have been other studies of stem cells, but they use the stem cells isolated from bone marrow or other organs, not from the heart. Nobody has used stem cells isolated from the heart in patients. So this will be the first in the world.
I see. Why was U of O and Jewish Hospital chosen for this?
Well, they were not really chosen. It happened that we have been working on these cells now for many, many years at the experimental level in the laboratory, in experimental animals. Several years ago, in collaboration with Dr. Anversa at Harvard Medical School, we discovered that the heart contains these cells. And we continued to investigate them. We tested them in various animal models of heart failure, ranging from mice to pigs. And we were impressed by the fact that these cells are able to regenerate heart muscle and to improve the function of the heart. So we thought the time had come for us to try to translate these basic findings to the human situation, and we applied to the Food and Drug Administration to use these cells in patients, and that was back in 2005. And the FDA was very interested. They thought this was a novel idea, which it is, and they asked us a lot of questions and asked for additional data. So it took us a few years to answer all the questions and generate all these additional data that the FDA required, but finally we received approval last year. And so the reason we are doing this study is because we have been the group that has, together with Dr. Anversa, discovered and characterized these cells in the heart.
I see. How long will the clinical trial last?
It's difficult to say precisely. We are enrolling 20 patients that will receive cells and 20 controls. If everything goes well, we should be finished enrolling in about a year, and then, as I said, the follow-up will be 2 years. So the whole study will require probably somewhere like 3 years to be completed.
I see. And you have begun enrolling patients for this?
Not yet. We are now just ready to enroll our first patient. We may have one next week, it looks like. We are not sure yet if he's a good candidate, but it will be probably in the next 2 weeks that we will enroll our first patient.
And these patients wouldn't necessarily be from the Louisville area?
No, they can be from anywhere in the country.
I see. And is there a time frame on when this actually will begin? Does it start right away?
Yes, so as soon as we find a candidate, we can collect this sample of the heart, as I said, during cardiac surgery. And it takes about 4 months to grow 1 million stem cells from that sample. So we will, after approximately 4 months, inject the cells into that patient, and then the patient will be followed up for 2 years.
Dr. Bolli, once again, congratulations and thanks for joining us this morning.
Well, thank you very much for your interest.
Dr. Roberto Bolli holds the Distinguished Chair in Cardiology at Jewish Hospital's Heart and Lung Institute. He'll be the study leader of the clinical trial involving adult cardiac stem cells. When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer reports on the economy and bookmobiles. You're in Studio 619 on WFTL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldon. Coming up, Kristen Espelon finds out how the weak economy is affecting Louisville's tourism industry. First, yes, the economy is tanking, but library use is climbing. The American Library Association says patrons nationwide are checking out more books and movies and using computers and reference materials for job searches. And in many of Kentucky's rural areas, the demand for library services extends far beyond the stacks, prompting Elizabeth Kramer to hit the back roads.
Jim Tucker is taking me for a ride. He's a librarian and a driver for the Casey County Library's bookmobile. Today, we're crisscrossing the hills of central Kentucky to visit homes and schools.
And this is our first stop.
Where are we?
We are on the top of South Fork Ridge at the home of Micah Bird and his mother.
Michael Bird, a stout man with a beard, steps into this book-lined van with an armload of some very thick books.
Good morning.
Good morning, y'all. How are y'all today?
Fine. And I've got some books you might want to look through.
Bird reads about 10 books a week and cares for his 93-year-old mother round the clock. Like many people on Tucker's routes, he doesn't get to the county seat of Liberty often.
Be careful going home in the snow.
I will.
And there are many people like Bird along this roughly 1,000 miles Tucker travels each month. There are also Amish communities, families who homeschool their children, and schools. In a year's time, Tucker makes about 500 unique stops to serve more than 4,000 patrons. Meanwhile, the economic crisis has prompted the state to cut funding to local libraries by nearly 15% and eliminate the grant program that once helped purchase new vehicles. Casey County Library Director Jan Banks says librarians throughout the state are feeling the pinch.
Most libraries that I know will squeeze a penny till it squeals, but we've got to have those pennies to squeeze.
Banks says she saves money by putting off the purchase of materials and computers, but she wouldn't dream of cutting the bookmobile program.
Would be kind of a cruel thing to do. I don't know if the cruel is exactly the word, but it's a program that helps people that really need assistance. It gives them someone that comes to their house when they might not see anybody for a long time.
Kentucky has 85 bookmobiles, more than any other state, and a deep devotion to them. It's tied to a rich history and a project to boost literacy headed by Mary Bingham of the family that owned Louisville's prominent media properties. In 1954, the project presented the governor with 84 vehicles. Today, many of the nation's 900 bookmobiles, including some in Kentucky, are outfitted with computers. Some are designed for specific use by the elderly or, like the bookmobile at the Kenton County Public Library in Covington, to serve young children at daycare centers. Wayne Ongst once worked on the bookmobile there. Today, he's the commissioner of Kentucky's Department for Libraries and Archives. He says bookmobiles are more efficient than opening up new branches, and they do more than help people read.
In many rural counties, many of the residents are so isolated, and the bookmobile is a lifeline.
But keeping bookmobile programs alive could become a problem. As the state reduced funding, some libraries like those in Casey and Kenton counties began supporting their bookmobiles through sponsorships from businesses. But that kind of support might not last in this economic crisis, and it has some librarians, like Jan Banks, wondering how some of Kentucky's bookmobiles will stay on the road. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
There's hardly an industry that's not affected by the current economy. Tourism is no exception, but as the Louisville Convention and Visitors Bureau head Jim Wood tells Kristen Espelon, The city is managing to attract some major conventions.
What we're seeing since, and this trend has begun back in August of 2008, that a little bit less people are attending the convention. Our attrition ratio is anywhere between, 1 to 5% up to 35% on a couple of conventions. That means a company that might send 6 to 8 people to a trade show, they're going to send 4 to the trade show. So companies are still going, they're still traveling, they're just sending less people to do business this year.
Tourism is actually faring better than some industries here. Is that your view?
Well, I can say that we have not been hit as hard as some other industries irrelevant to the economy. We were down in occupancy by 1.5 last year in 2008, and that's not bad, all things being equal. We were up in average room rate just a little bit. Some of our attractions did okay. They held their own in 2008. So knowing that we stepped into this recession in December of 2007, and we really were able to connect the dots and do well in 2008, I think we've done well, but we still don't know if that other shoe is going to drop or not in 2009 as the recession gets deeper and deeper.
How important is leisure travel in terms of its economic impact here?
Yeah, leisure travel is very significant. One of the largest leisure travel segments is what we call the VFR market. That means visiting friends and relatives. About 40% of our entire leisure segment is the VFR market. And those are the people that are staying in folks' homes and visiting with them. And then they go out to the community, enjoy the restaurants, the shopping, the nightlife, the attractions. So we know that segment will get hit. People might put off visiting some relatives or some friends. They might combine a couple of trips into one. So we are going to see a reduction in leisure travel. The senior market, we will see a retraction in the senior market, which 25% of the entire leisure travel segment is from the leisure audience, knowing that their 401ks have been hit particularly hard. As they look at their statements, they're going to reduce a couple of trips, and that's what the forecasters are telling us for 2009.
And your new website, is that for these partners? Is that for the group who came to the summit?
Yeah, we've launched a new website. This is our second website. It's called lcvb.info, and on that is all of our research that we've put out there, our convention surveys, research on leisure customers, convention customers, trending, and things of that. So it's really designed for people in our industry who are looking for some research tools to help build their marketing plans or to help them build and format their strategies in 2009, kind of a one-stop shop for the hospitality industry. And if there will be a blog on that. I'll have a blog, and I've already printed a couple of stories on that, and it allows people to kind of comment back based on what is written on there. And the objective of the blog is to talk about and communicate current trends that are happening and sharing with businesses on how they can correct themselves on the dime. So we want to stay as fluid as possible during these unique economic periods that we're in.
You mentioned in terms of conventions that you're seeing just fewer numbers of people getting sent to conventions. What about the dollars meeting planners have to spend? Are you seeing a contraction there as well?
Yeah, there's definitely a contraction with dollars that meeting planners are spending as well. And what they're looking to do is they'll cut a few corners. They might eliminate a coffee break here. They might tell everybody on the second day of the function their lunch is on their own. They won't do a catered meal. They may not do an opening reception, or they might do a reception in lieu of a sit-down dinner. So they are seeing a little bit. There's a tightening of their budgets, but as the membership and attendance goes for those annual conventions, so goes their budgets as well. So they're very cognizant of the fact that they need attendance, and as attendance is a little softer, anywhere, again, as I said, 1% to 35%, that has a significant impact, not only that annual convention, but on their budget for the whole year, because the annual convention funds many associations' activities for the course of the year. So it's important for them to drive attendance, and we try to partner with them in helping and coming up with some ideas and some tools to help drive attendance so that they won't be cash-strapped as they get into the rest of the year.
And then, of course, there's the public perception about other kinds of meetings, like incentive meetings or, big executive powwows and things like that. This public perception that, companies who they perceive as having been wasteful or irresponsible shouldn't be doing that. Are you feeling the effects of that as well?
Louisville is not really on the circuit for the incentive market, so we don't really feel the impact of that segment per se. The Sun Belt market does, Hawaii does, the Caribbean especially does. But in terms of, we still encourage companies to travel. They might retract a little bit with their businesses, but we want them to travel smart. We know there's a reduction in business travel from 1.9 staying overnight, 1.9 days versus now it's 1.5 days people are doing on corporate travel. But we still encourage travel. We still encourage those face-to-face meetings. It's important for our industry. It's important for our economy. It stimulates the overall economy when people travel. And we also know that, you know, with the government stimulus package that they're offering the banks and some of the financial institutions, they're asking them to not have the big lavish parties and events that they've scheduled for. We understand that. We get that. And Louisville has been immune to that because that type of business historically, again, falls into Las Vegas and some other bigger cities that has the glitz and glitter, and we're more of a meat and potatoes destination. So that's why we've done well and why we've been able to hold our own, because we have a very core audience that is strong for us, and it's a segment that really isn't hit that hard based on the current economic trends.
That was Jim Wood of the Louisville Convention and Visitors Bureau speaking with Kristen Espeland. When we come back, we'll get information from the mayor on how Louisville is looking ahead to the upcoming year. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Haldit. Coming up, Kristen Espeland talks with Kentucky's state climatologist about how the recent ice storm may have affected the state's drought. First, on Wednesday, Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson spoke before the Metro Democratic Club. The speech was a precursor of sorts to the annual State of the City address, which has been postponed until March because of last month's ice storm.
I wanted to talk a little bit about, speaking of need, what's happening in this community today. And I, as I look around this room, many of you know it as well as I do. We're having a significant problem in America today in terms of unemployment, in terms of the economy. The month of December, we had 16,000 people in Louisville, Jefferson County lose their jobs. In the month of December, we had 25,255 Louisville, Jefferson Countyans file for unemployment insurance. That was double what it was the month before. So things are difficult, and many of us who are in the public service business interact with an awful lot of people who are going through difficulties, and I'm sure there are probably very few people in this room today who do not know someone who has been affected by the downturn in the economy. A loved one, a family member, or a friend who simply is unemployed as a result, not of a result of what he or she has done, but as a result of the economy. I was at the unemployment office the other day, and I was standing in line. There were hundreds of people were filing. I met several people who had never been in unemployment line before, Rocky, never. I met a guy who was in charge of global outsourcing. I don't know what that means, for Yum Brands. Sounded pretty impressive to me. He was there in a jacket and tie, looked like he was about 40, 45, first time in his whole life he was unemployed. So we've got a lot of people that are hurting, and I've had the opportunity as one of the mayors to meet several times now with President-elect at the time and now President Obama to sort of talk about the issues that we're reading about and we're hoping for in terms of the stimulus package. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that so that we're all understanding the same factual situation, and we all understand how important this package and what it's going to mean to this community and this state and this nation is to the future of this country. Let me first say that the first time I met with President-elect Obama was up in Chicago, where he invited a dozen mayors 6-7 weeks ago to visit with him and with his alter ego, a woman by the name of Valerie Jarrett, to talk about what was happening in cities. And we had mayors there from Salt Lake City to Denver, from Los Angeles to Boston, Atlanta to Chicago, myself, talking about what our communities were going through and talking about the importance of getting people back to work. And what I thought was very interesting at that time is that all of the mayors and the staff of, at that time, President-elect Obama, who was there, we were all talking about getting people back to work, and we were focusing on, in our mindset, sort of the WPA kind of an approach. Let's get people back to work. Let's get them building the things we need. I mean, go out Frankfurt Avenue. Look at the waterworks. You know, go to the building right behind the county courthouse, the fiscal court building. Those were all built. Those were all WPA projects. Look at so many of the old libraries. And so we were thinking that way. And I'll never forget the president-elect. He was right on target. He said, you know, he said, that's great and that's important and we need to do that. But at the same time, we need to realize that a lot of people who are being laid off who are unemployed don't know how and aren't interested in learning how to run a backhoe, to drive a Caterpillar tractor. You know, they're not prepared tomorrow or interested or have the background or physical ability to go out and be a carpenter or a plumber or a construction worker. And therefore, he said, one of the things I'm going to try to focus on is ensuring that in the package we submit, there is a significant slug of dollars for training. Because the reality is, in some industries in this country, the jobs that are being lost are not going to come back. In many industries, they are, and they'll grow and they'll blossom and they'll expand. But in many industries, those jobs are not going to come back. So the question is, what do you do with those American citizens who want to work? And the answer is, you develop a training program. In this community, it's called the Kentuckiana Works, where you reach out to folks who are ready to be retrained, because the day of starting at Ford and ending at Ford, you hope it's still there. You'll certainly be there in terms of jobs, but the reality is most people will change their jobs more than 2, 3, 4 times during their lifetime. The old days of working at GE, of working in the same law firm, of working at the same newspaper, those days are over because things are changing so quickly. People make changes in their lives. And so you're constantly educating and re-educating yourself to be able to take the jobs of tomorrow. I'm sure when the success comes and we begin the, well, when we announce the new Ford vehicles that'll be made at the assembly plant and the hundreds of millions of dollars that's going to be invested there to restructure the entire process and to build a new platform out there, you know, maybe, who knows, nobody knows this yet, maybe there'll be an electric battery car that'll be a part of that experience. And if so, people are going to have to retrain in terms of how do you handle a car now that you're building it that is a battery-driven car rather than a gasoline-driven car. It's a constant change that has to occur. And so the president-elect saw that, and if you look at both the Senate and the House bill, there's a significant number of billions of dollars specifically set aside for training. We also felt, and the next time I met with the president-elect, was at George Mason University in Virginia, where he rolled out the stimulus package in terms of concepts. And I was there with about 8 or 10 mayors and about 6 or 7 governors. And that was the first time that I had a chance to meet the lead economic team that President Obama has put together. The former president of Harvard University, Larry Summers, the former head of the New York Fed, now Secretary Geithner, Secretary of the Treasury, and a lady who, she and her husband are economists at Berkeley, who has written extensively on tax structure and things of that nature, who is now the head of the Council of Economic Advisors. Her name is Rome. And they talked to us about what their game plan was as they were putting together the package to look forward. And you began to hear from them a lot of things that we normally think of as Republicanisms, meaning, you know, along with investment in infrastructure, along with building roads, along with building schools, modernizing and building schools, along with building bridges, along with upgrading the HVACs and the energy consumption in buildings throughout this country, along with working on foreclosures and housing problems that are occurring, there also needs to be some tax benefits to get businesses to begin buying more machinery, extending more inventory opportunities for those. Thinking in terms of a tax benefit for you as a parent if your child is in college. Thinking about a tax benefit for you if you're going to buy a home. And both the Senate and the House bill has a significant tax benefit. Thinking about an opportunity for a tax benefit if you're going to buy a car, which is in the Senate bill, interestingly enough, not the House bill. I think it was all your sales tax and all your interest on the purchase of a vehicle in the year 2009 end up being, I think, tax credits. So all of a sudden, you began to see a group of individuals who were willing to create a balanced approach that would focus on tax benefits to spur business growth and expansion, even a tax benefit for a company that is hiring individuals. You get a tax credit, you finally get Ray Kreider a job, and the next thing you know, you get a $500 tax credit for your company because you went out and got Ray Kreider out of his house to do something, you know? So those are the kinds of things that are in there. So it's a stimulus package that literally creates an opportunity for this country to believe that over time, significant amounts of jobs would be created. Now, what did we do in this community in preparation? We sat down with our sewer leadership in the Metropolitan Sewer District, leadership in the water company, in the transit authority, in the roads and bridges in our public works department, in the airport, in the school system, in the university, in the community college. And we said, okay, show us shovel-ready projects that can be let in 90 to 120 days and completed in 24 months. That's the way the president's folks said they wanted us set up. And that's what we did. And this community submitted $650 million package that would create 18,000 jobs. 18,000 jobs. 18,000 jobs would bring down the unemployment rate by close to 3%. You know, we're at 7 plus. Bring it down 3% if we could get 18,000 jobs. Now, that's if we got everything that we had asked for. And the mayors across the country submitted all of the responses, as did the governors. The governors throughout the United States submitted projects, road projects, et cetera. So the hope is that as the ultimate decision, now that the Senate has passed and now the House has passed, and someone said today, although I haven't heard, that they were very close to resolving the whole thing. Did that happen, Marty? Did it get resolved? Good, good. And Congressman Yarmuth has done just a superb job in representing this community in terms of focusing the attention on getting people back to work and focusing the attention on what we need in this country for our future. Because there is no question in my mind, I don't know how you all, what you think about this, but I don't think the American people realize how close we are to the edge. And as a result, it is a very frightening thing to think about if, in fact, we were unable to get our act together. Now, at the same time, you saw the president submit what he was going to do with the remaining $350, give or take, billion dollars for the financial institutions. And although the Secretary of the Treasury got a little static for not being as specific as some would have liked, the reality is that half that money, $350 billion, has been spent already with our banks and already with our financial institutions. And most people agree that the credit markets have not eased up. In fact, many of the banks can't seem to explain to the American people where the money went. You know, and then somebody the other day said, well, all they did was use it to buy banks. Well, the reality is, in this community, PNC bought National City. And they probably did use some of the dollars to buy National City. But if you happen to be a National City bank customer, the situation of ensuring that you were protected and the consolidation of the banks would ensure a financial base for us to grow from was a very important aspect. But what Bush did wrong, as most economists will tell you, is they held nobody accountable. There was no transparency. There was no requirements in terms of how the money was spent. It just was, the sky was falling, now was the time you needed to invest. And then they'd let this company, like Merrill Lynch, go into a bank, like Bank of America, but they let this company, Lehman Brothers, which had been an investment banking house for centuries, just go bankrupt. So there was no rhyme or reason. I think what you're going to find with the President Obama's team and the way it was framed up yesterday is that there will be transparency, there will be opportunities to ensure that people more than likely will be able to stay in their homes through the foreclosure situation. There'll be a focus on the attention of making sure that if you're going to take the government money, you're going to, in fact, loan that money, and you'll be able to see that. People will be able to watch that. And if you're going to take the money, you're not going to get $100 million bonuses, and you're not going to make $100 million a year. I mean, all the kinds of things that I think, unfortunately, the American people got off on such a wrong track with the last 6 months of the Bush administration, and we lost $350 billion. And, you know, we're all sort of getting sensitive or callous to that B number. You know, you did a billion here, billion there. I mean, what the heck? It's just another billion. The money comes from us, ultimately. The money comes from our kids and our grandkids, ultimately. And so it will have an effect as time goes by in terms of what else we're able to do with the dollars we pay in our taxes for the future of this country. This investment is beyond what Eisenhower did in the 50s for the interstate highway system. That's the kind of major, major investment that's being proposed by the stimulus package. And we're going to participate in it. We're going to be involved in it to make sure things go forward. Ray wanted to know about our senior senator, what he doesn't understand about that. You'd have to ask him. I don't know. Our two senators voted against it. Let's hope that when it comes back after an agreement from the conference committee that they'll vote for it. And if they don't, let's at least hope two people from Maine and one from Pennsylvania do vote for it. And as long as the ladies from Maine and the gentleman from Pennsylvania vote for it, we'll be able to go forward. I'll tell you one other thing, and then I'll stop, because you all probably want to ask some questions. There are some good things happening. And I'm a glass half full kind of guy. I mean, if I see a glass, I'll always tell you it's half full. I will never tell you it's half empty. I am a positive thinking person, and I like to look on the positive side of issues. And there are some good things going on in this community and in this country. In this community, there has been growth in several industries. The healthcare industry continues to hire. I mean, Humana picked up another 1,000 people over the last year or so. You know, ZerMed is building a high-rise building, and they're growing like leaps and bounds. Another healthcare, IT, informatics kind of business. Healthcare, education, look what's going on at the University of Louisville. Look at the investment happening at the community college. Look at the opportunities in the logistics business that continues to grow here with our good fortune of having UPS. You know, there are a lot of good things going on. They're expanding not only at UPS, but they're expanding at the university college program. We've got more young people getting a free ride to college by simply working at UPS at night. Free books, free fees, free tuition, free. And they can go on to be doctors or lawyers or business people, whatever they want to be. They don't have to be, they don't have to dress in brown the rest of their life. But that program continues to grow and expand, and more people are being educated. University of Louisville had the best class it's ever had in terms of students, the quality of the students at Bellarmine, at Spalding. More and more investment in this education experience has been working out exceptionally well. And the same thing is happening with our public schools. And let me just close with saying I was in Frankfurt today, which is always a very interesting experience. I mean, it's one of those things you got to do. And I hope everybody's watching very, very clearly, because there are a lot of tough issues. You know, it's one thing for me to tell you I'm $20 million in the hole and the council and I are going to have to make this up before we get to June 30th. It's another thing for me to tell you we're almost $490 million in the hole and Governor Beshear and the legislature has to make it up within this year. It's not the biennium that shortfall. It's 1 year of the biennium. $470 million. And the kinds of issues that are going on up there are the kinds of issues that, as informed citizens and people who believe in public issues and public policy, you need to keep an eye on. Because not only are the dollars and cents in the budget going up, there's a lot of moving and shaking going on regarding a bill here and a bill there that sort of slips through and the slips there. And the next thing you know, we in Louisville are bound to do this or we can't do that, as a result of some of the wild hares that are flying around up in Frankfurt. So I hope that you will keep in touch with your legislators and keep in touch with the issues of the day so that each of them understands they're a part of this community. And together, you know, they make our delegation. And with the leadership of Larry Clark, whom I met with, and the leadership of so many of the other folks who have been working, we're trying to bring those folks together as a delegation and speak as a community so that when we need them for investments in this community, they'll be there. And when we need them to be able to stop things that out in the state they want to do to this community, we need you all to speak out on those kinds of issues too.
That was Louisville Mayor Jerry Abramson talking about some of the challenges the city faces in the upcoming year. 2 years of drought in Kentucky have harmed farm yields, caused water shortages, and driven up the price of hay, but the recent ice storm may have helped. Kristen Espelon spoke with Kentucky's state climatologist, Stuart Foster, who says the ice recharged the state's water supplies.
Well, I think the ice storm, more as a precipitation event, has greatly alleviated our lasting concerns about the lingering drought here in Kentucky. This is a time of year where we don't use a lot of water, and so we had anywhere from 3 to 5 inches or more of precipitation out of this storm event, which left ice over much of Kentucky. And I think that's really helped quite a bit to recharge our water supplies at this point.
And those water supplies, would those be water tables, reservoirs, rivers?
It includes all of those things. Certainly the first impact shows up in terms of our soil moisture in the upper layers of soil has been quite wet here, and that's typical of the wintertime. River levels have come up quite a bit. Reservoirs are regulated by the Army Corps of Engineers and are generally kept lower here in the winter anyway in terms of flood control. What's really the key is sort of the long-term effect in terms of it helping to replenish our water table, our groundwater levels, which had been depleted quite a bit, actually, from our 2007 drought and then in 2008 in parts of the state, particularly more to the south. So I think it's helped quite a bit with that. But again, if we turn dry again this spring and such, we could have problems surface again later in the summer.
We've essentially then been in about a 2-year drought. How does that compare with drought events of the past? Is it record breaking in any way?
No. We are not in that kind of situation now. The 2007 drought, it certainly started out early. We were dry in the spring, and by late April and into May, we recognized that even though the situation didn't seem too bad at that time, the farmers that were trying to harvest their hay recognized it was bad, but most people didn't. The situation deteriorated quite a bit when we got into July, August, September, and as you may remember, and many of your listeners, August of 2007 was extremely hot, and in some parts of the state was the hottest month on record going back to the 1800s when our record started. But then we kind of recovered. October of 2007 was unusually wet, and just at the time when we needed it. So that helped us to probably alleviate what was tracking to become a very, very serious drought historically. But if we go back in Kentucky and look in the drought of 1930 and 1931 is our drought of record that we compare other droughts to. And we've also had periods of extended drought, multi-year drought in the early 1940s and again in the 1950s. So what we've seen was bad in some areas of the state, but history suggests that it could have been much worse.
So going forward, you mentioned that, you know, if we have a dry spring, we could see some problems. But is there any way to kind of forecast, if you will, what we could see in terms of crops, for example, hay harvesting in the future?
Right.
Do you think farmers will be given a break there?
Well, we certainly hope so. It's very difficult to forecast our climate patterns that far out. There is a better and better understanding of sort of the global and hemispheric atmosphere circulation patterns that affect our climate and cause us to get into periods of dryness or periods where we're wet. But it's extremely difficult to pin it down with a high degree of certainty. What we can say is that there is some research in the area of climatology that would suggest that we, within the last few years, have entered a phase where we may be prone to more frequent periods of drought for the next decade or two. It's a possibility. It's certainly not a prediction, a guarantee in any sense, but I think we should be aware that our climate does vary, and we've had periods in the past, going back to the Dust Bowl era that people remember, or have read about, where we had frequent drought, and it's possible that we might get into a situation where drought becomes more frequent than it has been over the last 3 or 4 decades.
Are you willing to make a connection with climate change, with global warming?
It may be tied to global warming, but what it also appears to be connected to are patterns of sort of oscillations in ocean temperatures. And there are a number of different indexes out there that climatologists use. Two that have been mentioned in research in the last few years, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation and the Atlantic Multi-Decadal Oscillation are kind of lining up in a way that historically suggests that, again, we might be in a, for a period of more frequent drought for the next decade or so.
Over the past year and the year before, we had drinking water shortages in some counties in the state and throughout the Southeast. How strong, how complete is our understanding of our water supply in the state of groundwater measurements?
We do not have an extensive groundwater monitoring network in place, and most states don't, to be honest. It would be certainly nice to have a little bit more actual data. I'm confident that you know, we have some good people in the, with the Division of Water in Frankfort that kind of have a good level of expert knowledge about some of these things. But I think when we think of water supply in Kentucky in general, that we rely probably more on our rivers and streams and reservoirs. And certainly the Ohio River there is a wonderful source of water for Kentucky, and Kentucky's fortunate that it owns the Ohio River. But having said that, there are certainly areas in the state and some rural areas where people and farmers and such are very much affected by the availability of groundwater. So when we talk about drought, it's something that we become aware of it when we're in the midst of one, but what we need to remain conscious of is that drought is a recurrent feature of our climate. It happens, and we can count on it happening again in the future. We need to learn from each drought experience that we have and try to do a better job of planning for those situations when they arise, and I think we are learning from each event and do a better job.
Dr. Stuart Foster, state climatologist, thank you so very much.
You're very, very welcome.
You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts from our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howland. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.